On the East Coast, we found 10 out of 260 collection deaths, which provided evidence of mixed populations. This observation suggests that a multi-maternal colony was present, and this is what other workers, other papers showed previously, as Jenkins and co-workers in Georgia, or Deheer and Vargo in North Carolina, Fisher in Texas, and other people in Japan. And finally, and lastly, we identified Virginicus and Flavipes in the studied site.
Females feed, that's the female reproductive tract here. So ovipositor, and we'll see in just a second where the spermatophore attaches. So here, this is a spermatophore, this thing here. Inside we have the ejaculates, and what happens? Well, the male basically tries to insert that into that small hole. When they break apart, it's very easy to see if the female still has the spermatophore, whether or not you had scored as a successful copulation or not. And so here, you can see the spermatophore is attached to the female. And what happens once it's attached? Well, we expect that the ejaculate actually makes it all the way through the reproductive tract and ends up getting to the sperm storage organ here, the spermatheca. Okay, makes sense. It's fine. So what happens then in order to get to fertilization? Well, in this case, eggs are coming through here, through the oviduct, and then some of the ejaculates has to get out and eventually fertilize the egg. The fertilized egg is then laid in the soil. Okay? Has everybody got that? Everybody pretty happy with? Woohoo! That's right. So, the kinds of traits we're talking about have to occur right here. Okay? Reproductive isolation in this group, okay, this rapidly diverging group, has to occur here. Okay? Between the time, good grief, when the spermatophore attaches, the sperm is being stored, and then all the way up to fertilization. Okay, so somewhere in there, these species are different. So how do we go about figuring out dissecting what the genetics of these traits are? And well, to do that, we need to be able to identify the proteins that are in each of the reproductive tracts, right? All the ejaculate proteins for the males, all the reproductive tract proteins for the females. When you look at how they interact, right? When you look at how they interact. And then finally, which is sort of the small part of what I'll talk about today, is the RNAi. We got to be able to knock down individual proteins, either in the ejaculate or the female reproductive tract, to actually see what their role is. Okay. So, what are we doing now? We're taking a genomics and proteomics approach, and starting basically doing protein work with each of the reproductive tissues, so or components. So we're doing the ejaculates. We're also doing the female reproductive tract and the female sperm storage organ. We look at how they diverge between species or among divergent populations. We take those things that are different. We use the wonderful world of proteomics, which I'm just learning about, so I don't know what I'm talking about, but my colleagues do. And we pick them, we identify them, we have some transcriptome data, we're generating more transcriptome data. We figure out what the heck they are, and go from there, right? So we have possible candidates, but what do we do with them then? Well, we need to be able to knock them out. And so that's what we did. We said, well, could we do it? Well, one of the most abundant proteins that we found in the spermatophore, so each of these are just individual spermatophores, just to give you a number that may seem pretty astounding. Sort of the average amount of protein in an ejaculate is like 60 micrograms. So I'm not sure if y'all recognize, but that's a hell of a lot of protein in there. This was just one of the most abundant ones. It's a serine protease. I won't talk about it any more than that. We used that region in red to generate double-stranded RNA. We had a couple of treatments for now for privacy reasons, I guess. We'll call it ejaculate protein 1. Double-stranded RNA for that. The other one, just saline, okay, and just injected into the abdomen. So nothing fancy. And then what we did to actually score whether or not we were knocking out the ejaculate protein, we just stole spermatophores from males, right? So from a given male, we may track him over 8, 9, 10 days, and we did that for a bunch of different males, and we actually did end up doing multiple regions of the gene and that sort of thing. So in this case, we have saline injected, double-stranded RNA injected. This is actually a sperm protein, this guy here. And here is actually our double-stranded, our protein of interest. So let me go back. It's this thing here. Okay. So we look at it, and what do we see? Well, in the saline injected, after 2 days, 4 days, 7 days, it doesn't go away, right? Which is what you would expect. In this case, we use the double-stranded RNA. We actually can track that it actually does go away quite nicely. And here, so this is a summary of about 35 or 40 individuals, just tracking days after injection here, expression level here, saline injected, double-stranded RNA injected, and we can see that we can knock it out. And we have some really cool phenotypes, but you don't get to hear about that. So, here's a shameless plug. So this was all part of some preliminary data. We were lucky. Just got NSF funding. We have a lot of openings in lab. And if you're looking or have students that are looking, we do great work. So that's it. Quick talk, nice and dirty, and I'll take questions. Go ahead.
Out of the several proteins you showed, why did you choose the one that...
It was just one of the most abundant. Yep, completely random.
Just down that protein, I mean, just below that protein, there was the one which had a greater amount of secretion. Or
yep.
Expression.
We looked at it, too. Sure did. That's it. We have a paper that'll come out sometime this coming up year, and you can read all about it. At that point, go ahead, sir.
After you injected the double-stranded RNA, these were northern that you were showing.
Say that again.
The thing that you showed after injection, the double-stranded RNA. Are these northern blocks?
Oh no! In this case, that's so.
It's just
Kumasi. So we haven't done. We were actually developing the specific antibody. That's the word.
Yeah, but did you do northern blot to see how much RNA?
We didn't bother, because in this case, all we care about is whether or not we can get rid of the protein that's in the spermatophore. That's all we care about.
Can you inject multiple?
In this case we injected once.
I understand, but are you planning on injecting multiple double-stranded RNA?
Right now we're just going to do it on a gene by gene basis.
But yes, you can.
So yes, you can. But in this case, we're interested in doing a single protein at a time. I think back here and then. Okay, so it was 0.8 micrograms per microliter. We injected a microliter, and we did it in about the third abdominal space, basically. Is that it? What? How much and where?
How much do you pay?
You can talk to me in a minute. So I think here, then back there.
Why does it take 7 days for the protein expression?
Well, in this case, so... In this case, they've already produced, I imagine, right? Because we're just scoring protein, right? We're not actually scoring the transcript level. They already have a ton of it there. I mean, these reproductive tissues are huge. And so if we actually take spermatophores from males and track it, if you took a whole bunch of spermatophores from a male over 2 or 3 days, you might get close to that 7 day. Yeah.
So these guys should be shedding them all the time.
No. They produce them. They only produce them right before copulation.
We have to stop here. Sorry.
I'm always willing to talk about sex stuff, though, so see me afterwards.
So you can read again the title of my talk. All our research basically have a single objective, which is to detail the molecular basis of wood digestion in termites. And here's a system that we're trying to detail. So we are working with a reticulitamus flavipes. I'm sorry, let me use the mouse. Oops, that was a bad start. And we are basically trying to detail that gut, which is basically a wood digesting machine. Okay, so there's a lot of... This is going to be annoying. There's a lot of enzymes that are secreted all around the gut, and reticulus flavipes is a lower enzyme, meaning that it has both eukaryotic and prokaryotic symbionts inside the hindguts. Let me see if I can use the mouse this time. So the hindguts... Wow, the hindguts would be dead. Okay, that's where all the symbionts are, and of course, all the symbionts are involved into the digestive process, meaning that they are secreting a lot of enzymes that degrade wood, cellulase, gluconase, xylanase, that type of thing. But they're pretty much localized in the hindguts over here. There's actually enzymes that are being secreted in the midgut and the foregut, including the salivary gland, and those enzymes have been shown to come from the termite genome. So there's basically two different sets of enzymes, if you will. There's enzymes that come from termites that are encoded by genes that are present in the termite genome, that's the ones I'm going to talk about today. And there's other enzymes that come from endosymbiont population. If you think about it, it's actually a lot more complex than this, because there are different species of microbial organisms within the endosymbiont populations. Some of those species are actually fairly distant in terms of phylogenetic relationships, and supposedly they all secrete their own enzymes. Okay, so there's a bunch of enzymes in there, and all the interaction between the states are not very well understood right now. So one of the objectives of our study is to look at all those enzymes following a metagenomic project. Okay. So we're basically sequencing a bunch of genes, and we started by sequencing genes, or genes that come from the termite genome. So we started working with guts that was removed or freed of endosymbionts, just looking at the genes coming from the termite genome that can encode enzymes that are potentially involved into the digestion of wood. Just to make sure that we're on the same page, that's actually the first phase of a more comprehensive project in which we're hoping to look at genes that are expressed by both eukaryotic and prokaryotic symbionts. Okay, right now we're looking at just termites, so we dissect guts, extracting RNA, constructing a CNA library, and sequence a bunch of clones, so by EST sequence. And here's the data of the result of our sequencing effort. We basically sequence a little bit more than 7,600 clones, so it's 80, 96 well played, if you can do the math real quick. Did a little bit of cleanup, assemble some contigs. What we have now, what we're looking at, is a database that is that contains around 3,000 genes. Okay. And first thing we did, or one of the first things we did, is blast everything so that we can have an idea of what the genes actually are or what proteins they encode. And from those blast analyses, we were able to identify only 1800 or so genes, meaning that those genes produce a blast hit. All the other one, 1200 or so, are unknown so far. So we are trying to go through those, looking for some motifs maybe. A little bit of details about those 1800 genes or so. Here's a pie chart that represent or that classify the first blast of every gene. Taxonomically, so looking at the phylogenetic signals of the genes that we have sequenced. Not surprising, we have a lot of genes that are similar to genes that were previously sequenced from other insects. Okay, so in terms of There's other invertebrate, vertebrate, nothing surprising. I want to point out to your attention that we actually found some genes that resemble genes that have been sequenced or supposedly sequenced from under symbionts. Okay? So probably there was a little bit of under symbionts into our dissected gut. Not a big deal if you consider the larger project, since we are interested in looking at those genes as well. So I didn't discard those genes for the further analysis that you're going to see in a minute. Sort of like an early preview of what we're going to do in the long term. We have so most of our genes are of enzyme. I mentioned that there's some genes that looks like they come from under symbionts. We're actually not sure here if there's some type of misannotation of where. Well, I should mention that when you look at all the genes from under symbionts that are present in the database, those are come from EST sequencing as well, and they're extremely poorly annotated. So you know there's not a lot of information on that, and it's hard to establish any type of conclusion. So what we are trying to do is once we sequence our symbionts library, we are looking forward to some cross-referencing in between our library to make sure, like try to point out, or pinpoint, I should say, the exact phylogenetic origin of each gene. A little bit more time-consuming, but nevertheless, with the BLAST analysis, we were able to identify a list of very promising genes that seems to be, or that possibly can be involved into the breakdown of wood and large carbohydrate molecules. Okay, so I'm not going to show you a list of 150 genes, but I can show you a little bit of the type of diversity of the genes that we obtained. We basically classified them into large family depending on their growth function. So either they are beta glucosidase, alpha glucosidase, lignases, so all those particular type of families that were extremely interesting into characterizing. Okay. Another type of another representation would be that you find the family here that we identify, so growth family of enzymes that are involved on carbohydrates. And here I run some comparative analysis. So again, trying to pinpoint where those genes come from. Either they're coming from endosymbionts, since we have a little bit of that contamination, or more than likely they're coming from the termite genome. Okay, so you can actually look at insect genomes that have been fully sequenced that are extremely well annotated, looking for some homologs. And you can see that, so I looked at three genomes that are for which the annotation is the best. Anopheles, Apis, Drosophila, so mosquito, honeybee, and a fly if you're not familiar with the Latin names. And basically most of our enzymes that we identify have a pretty strong phylogenetic signal, all come from, they all look like insect genes basically, except here, the beta glycohydrolase, which is the family that would contain all the cellulase, glucanase, and xylanase, so enzymes that we are especially interested in. Nevertheless, there's a little bit of enzymes that are clearly comes from insects, an insect genome. Okay, here, and I'm going to detail that a little bit. I'm actually in the middle of, or in the midst of trying to annotate all those other glycohydrolase here. So either they're coming, either those genes are termite specific, or they're coming from endosymbionts. Okay. And that's what I'm trying to figure out by looking at every single of those genes one by one. There's only about 30 of them. Those 10 here have an extremely strong phylogenetic signal. They come from an insect genome, as I said, and they have extremely well characterized motifs. So this family of motif of glycohydrolase are coming from that website here that you can see here. So I just follow their nomenclature, and here are the known activities that they are that they have listed. Okay, so we have a list of 10. Let me go back here. You have those 10 here are the 10 transcript or 10 putative genes that I listed here, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, and 10. Okay, so 10 genes that are clearly from the termite genomes that codes for putatively enzymes that can break down carbohydrates. Okay. So the next step here is, as I annotate everything, that list is going to likely get bigger. And what we're trying to do now is looking at going back from the computer to the bench, so to speak, and looking at enzyme activities, whether or not we can express those clones, get the enzyme, look at the